This is Betty Smith, Not Without Aphrodite, 25th of February, 1990, tape 2 of 6.
And hurled it with a cry. And as the spear traveled over the heads of the warriors, the sky darkened momentarily, and an eagle swooped down and took the spear in his talons and carried it quite a little distance beyond, but still visible distance, and deposited it into the ground, swooping down a second time. This is recorded in the myth. The following day, again saw Amphiaraus and the warriors of Argos battling the defenders of Thebes. Amphiaraus found himself fighting on the very spot where the eagle had sunk his spear into the earth the previous day. He had recovered his spear. When he realized this, he trembled at the omen. This time, Amphiaraus drove his chariot. The ground, what happened then was an immense cloud darkened the sky, not an eagle. Immense cloud darkened the sky. Crashing thunder rang out, and a bolt of lightning struck the spot on the ground just beside the chariot, just in front of the chariot. The ground was cleft open as with a great battle axe and stood gaping open before the seer king's eyes. Calmly, Amphiaraus drove his chariot forward, nodding to invisible Zeus. And the bowels of the earth received Amphiaraus, his horses, and his chariot, so that they were never again seen in this lifetime. And the name of the place is called Harma, which means the chariot, the place of the chariot. Harma, H-A-R-M-A, the place of the chariot, Harma. Harma means chariot. Now, near the city of Oropus, they mark a different spot that he was claimed into the earth. So near his home. But most of the accounts say it happened near Thebes. And later, what happens is that a spring comes up out of the ground at the sacred spot where he was to have gone into the earth at Oropus, high up above the city in a pine grove. The spring came to be, and it became the sacred spring of Amphiaraus. And he reappeared, at least to certain people, as the great seer. He was now an immortal seer. And there is, up above the city of Oropus, in the woods, there is a most beautiful area in a kind of what would you call that? Not a ravine, but a gap between the great rocks where his oracle was given. It was a dream oracle long before Epidaurus was founded. It was a dream oracle from Amphiaraus. No one ever drank from the spring, sacred spring. No one ever bathed in the sacred spring. It was so holy because it was supposedly the spring out of which he returned to earth. And it's quite an extraordinary place. The initiates for many hundreds of years, they slept on stone benches out in the open under the sky and had their dream, and often wrapped up in a skin of a newly killed ram. The ram would be offered for sacrifice, and then they would wrap themselves in the animal skin. The end of Epiphyle is I presume a historic thing, as I say, this was legendary. You see the weaving of legend and myth in it. But she later was killed by her son as vengeance for the death of the father. And it's a very, very dark ending. So there again is your Androphonos, the Aphrodite world, sometimes having her crime very close by it. It doesn't mean that Aphrodite directly causes it, but that is in the dark side. And the necklace never came to Oropus. And it was a very sad ending. And I chose this myth. First I thought, oh, there's no way I can deal with that myth. I chose it because I think there's something of the modern condition in it for us. There's a great deal of desire for the Aphrodite renewal, the kind of renewal that she brings. A real sense of at-homeness with oneself, with one's own beauty, what's given by nature, one's own sense of worth. The bountifulness of existence is certainly with Aphrodite and the graces and the hours who are with her. And I think we long for that today. I don't think it's a thing in the collective that we have, collectively speaking. So I do think it's a sad myth of that that story. And yet, the reason I asked you, where is Aphrodite in all of this? Did she have anything to do with this? She's not usually a goddess of seers, but suppose she had been. I mean, this was a process that made a great seer out of Amphiaraus. You know, that's one part of it. That's one aspect. Yeah, and maybe we learn something about what you do with the desire world. You don't simply rush out there and make war and or theft.
So interested in his fate, which seems to be to fight for his wife, and where is actually the woman's desire? In some ways, she seems like a pawn to me.
In some ways, she's what?
A pawn. She's a desire was planted in her, and her husband believed in his fate anyway, so. Mm-hmm.
Oh yes, I think her death at the last is a very terrible thing.
Yeah, so but that seems to me also kind of she's a victim kind of in the beginning and also in the end. You can look at, because maybe she didn't have that desire in the first place. Maybe the brother really convinced her she needed this, and so she manipulates her husband, who in some ways is only seeing his own fate and not seeing what she really wants anyway. He's only seeing his fate as he has to serve her. So in the conversation, they're talking past one another, and then he goes out and does it, and he dies, and then she's killed in the end, and no desire is fulfilled, except that of the attempt to get the necklace, which is what the brother wanted, and at the hours to fulfill his fate.
Well, I think that's the usual view of this myth. I don't quite feel it that way. I feel it has a lot more, it's not just power play from beginning to end. I really think some of these things do really move us, the desire for something, and it does set up a particular fate in us, what we will do to get something we want. I think we have to see this side of us before it becomes moral. Somehow, some way. I don't know. It's a terrible story. It really is a very hard story. Yes?
It seems that she says to her husband she's suffering, and she's okay, because she wants these two. And also there's the side that she's getting older and might have something to do with that. And he could have just listened. And he could have said to her, that he understood she was in pain and been there with her in her pain, because it seems like with Psyche, the pain and the suffering have to do with inner change. Mm-hmm. But instead of giving that to her and allowing her to do that, he tried to make it better right away. I mean, he tried to do something to end the suffering, which had to do with her own transformation.
Well, it certainly excited the heroic side of him, didn't it? Really, it did. That brought it into play. But I don't think, I think our mistake is often feeling that a man can bring us what's missing if Aphrodite is missing. No fair. No fair. A man cannot bring you Aphrodite. And I mean, no criticism of the man, but I mean, it's an individual search and relationship.
Mm-hmm. So maybe in that sense, it's and speaking in an inner way, maybe say the woman who has a family, but that falls in love, her desire falls on some other man, and if she goes towards that as a goal, as an outer goal, throwing away what she wants, instead of maybe just staying with the suffering of desire, but not fulfilling the desire, then she could come through a change, and come to a change in the relationship she's in.
Yes, there. I hope you'll rewrite this myth and hope make it come out differently.
I'm really confused about how this decision was made, which seems really appropriate for today, because she expressed a desire. Mm-hmm. He didn't have to act the way he did on that desire. Mm-hmm. She said something about, "What have I done?" Mm-hmm. And it seemed like that's where, like, it's important that they would have gone a step further to have talked about it more and said, "Well, I'm not sure if I want you to do this." Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. She sent out the masculine to do for her what she could have chosen to do inwardly, maybe. Do you know what I'm trying
yes.
to say?
Yes. Yes. Well, don't we send the animus out pretty fast to do what the animus? Not necessarily the man, but we can send the animus out pretty fast to do the heroic thing, to bring us what is unrelated. I mean, he is unrelated to that. First place, he's unrelated to those gems, the animus is. The animus. We're not talking about a man right this moment. But he's unrelated to those gems because they belong to the feeling world, and the animus is not related to the feeling of a woman, I think, as such. A man can relate to feeling, but the animus is kind of in a different position, it seems to me. So, yes, there's much more process that's possible with Aphrodite, and I hope in the other myths we'll see some of the process that's possible. At least this brings in the overpowering, we have to stop now, overpowering realm of desire. Two of her companions, as they were later imaged, the graces and the hours were always with her, but later they also talk about himeros, which means desire, himeros, meaning desire is at her side, and also pytho, P-E-I-T-H-O. Pytho, persuasion. So she has these two aspects. And you have to understand the persuasion of Aphrodite is different from verbal persuasion. It's not clever arguments. It's not stacking up the cards a certain way. It's not a power play. But persuasion that is Aphrodite's is very magical and powerful. And sometimes in ancient Greece they would say a particular orator had pytho with him because he could so sway the people in a kind of a gentle way, a swaying that one just bows to, yields to. One yields to it. Not rationally, but yields to it. So these things are at work, and Amphiaraus is persuaded, even though she didn't even have a plan. She only had the goal in mind. And the desire burns very strongly in her. And but what one does then is a moral, ethical issue. Jung felt that, and I think he makes this quite clear in some of his letters, that it's very important to come to terms with the ethical side of yourself. And certainly he had no dogmatic feelings about it, but it's just that we are moral, ethical beings as modern individuals. And so what you do with what the unconscious brings is a moral, ethical issue. It's a... But very often Aphrodite gets cut off before we even get into the ethical court. So she does have these beautiful jewels. And by the way, Harmonia was the daughter of Aphrodite and Ares, the god of war. So we're going to go into that myth later. All right, I think we should... what our plan is, I think, is to take now almost... I'm not sure which Margaret.
All right.
Do you know to whom? Maybe this would be a good time to say a few things, just a few things, before we go into the next myth. And I should like to say some things about what Aphrodite gives us in just a little more specific way, trying to pull down things that aren't stated too specifically in the myth, but she calls forth from us, and I think this is obvious, a capacity to be open and receptive. She breaks through rigidities of habit, rigidities of dogma, sometimes of conventional ways of doing things. And out of that we can say that she belongs to our spontaneity. We have said that already, our spontaneity and our subjectivity. And as such, she stirs the feeling life. Whereas one was half to altogether bored, or something goes very dry, or life is terribly repetitious, she brings in a quality that suddenly stirs the feeling life. And at once one is, now these words sound maybe like a little overdrawn, but I have said at once one is enchanted, captured by feeling towards something or someone. One becomes captive very quickly. Enchanted may not be the way you would say it, but charmed, meaning that the senses and the feelings are drawn in almost without one's permission. There's the Pytho aspect. I am persuaded. I didn't know it. My beliefs aren't changed. My attitude towards life isn't changed, but suddenly I'm drawn in to something. I am persuaded. Now, in a non-rational sense of persuaded. Pytho has been present, and I am persuaded. So she does this for us. She shifts the power of the rational life, of the rational control in our lives. She shifts the power of it. She shifts it towards a natural satisfaction. Now, this is not necessarily physical or sexually overt. But I do think she makes us conscious of the fact that we are at all times physical and sexual beings, quite apart from any behavior. I mean, she brings the blooming energies of body and being to the fore in that broader sense of making us alive all the way through. But this has a way of shifting the rational control. There is an indefinable sense of meaning that she brings. I said she was a major deity of meaning in life. She brings the satisfaction into present time. And I've sometimes called her the god of the present moment, the goddess of the present moment. And her time is really present time. That means a great deal. In a way, it you can say it negatively, but in saying it in the positive sense of the word, and with the help of the existentialists for a moment, I mean, there is no time that affects reality except present time. And what you do with the past in the present time, what you do with the future in the present time is what matters. So, I mean, even from a rational and historical point of view, the present time is the moment of action, the moment of being, the moment of realization. And Aphrodite doesn't get there by arguing it that way. She gets there by valuing, as an earth goddess, what has come to be and is now, you see, whatever stage. If it's a seedling, how good to be a seedling. If it's a mighty tree coming into bloom, how good to be blooming. If it's dropping its bloom and it's going into fruit, it is a good time. Every present stage has her affirmation in it. It's her affirmation of what is natural, what is in season, what is appropriate, really, in a really natural sense of appropriate, goes with her. So I think she brings meaning in that sense. She doesn't bring meaning in a sense of an answer or a statement or an overall philosophy that is articulated. And we spoke of her bond, and let's see if there's anything else I want to add to that. Yes, there are some, excuse me, there are some ways that we lose Aphrodite. I think I wanted to just mention a few ways in which we lose her. This morning we spoke of misconceptions. Misconceptions that diminish her too much, that lock her up into too much of a package or too much of a department of life. And now I'd like to say further how we lose Aphrodite. One way is that we become incapable of the two, of true relatedness, the number two, belongs to Aphrodite and relationship, self and the other, dialogue. Love is always two complementaries or opposites coming together. And when one becomes, some very ordinary ways in which we become unready or unwilling for the two of relationship is we engage in monologues, primarily in monologues, and or we're only concerned, or or where we're needlessly or prolongedly narcissistic beyond what we need to be. We can't get beyond our own needs. To have that bit of freedom and accessibility for the other, to relate to the other. So there are different ways in which, but I think monologues in communication, when there is a time to communicate one with the other, undoes this. A second way we become incapable of the two is we perceive the other not as an individual or as unique, but as a representative. And women are very sensitive to this. If a man regards a woman just as a woman, and not the woman, but a woman, and the same with a man, doesn't want to be considered just as a man, but in his individuality and his nature. And I think when we see another as a representative, not only as man and woman, it can be of also of an archetype, you know, representative of an archetype, with unconsciously embracing somebody because she carries the mother, or he carries the father, or he carries the wise man, or she carries the inspiratrice, embracing as each other. Now, I think this happens in Aphrodite's world, but in the end, it does not support the unique love. It does not support that, I think. Somehow there's a missing of who the other is, so that the love is not really addressed to the other. It's addressed to something distant way behind there. A second way, besides not being capable of the number two of relationship, is we become behavior-oriented, and we demand that love prove itself in certain set ways. Sometimes we even number them, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. And I think love needs a freer hand. It's one thing to know what you need in relationship and be realistic about it, but love itself, if it's to have its way with us, and now I'm not talking about man-woman relationship or the partnership, but in all aspects of life, if love is to work its magic in us, it has to have a certain freedom, has to have a theater in which to work without a lot of our preconceptions or demands, you know. Certainly we never get the creative thing going if we... If the ego just calls all the shots and says, this is what this creative work is going to be, and this is what I'm going to say or do, and this is, has to give a little room to the goddess in this respect. And then a third way in which we lose Aphrodite, and this is, when I say we, I mean as a culture, is we no longer believe that love is divine. Yes. We no longer believe that love is divine, and therefore we do not believe it's infinite in its fertility. So we don't really believe in its power. That goes also with just the behavior orientation, I think. I don't know what all that means or implies for you, but if something really has a God in it, it has an enormous mystery in it, and it has a very strong potential force in it. And then the last aspect I wanted to speak of is there's a seeking that possesses us as modern individuals in the culture. And this seeking, this frenetic seeking, is not very fruitful towards arriving at Aphrodite. Seeking everywhere through all kinds of activity. One may or may not be seeking someone to love and be loved by. It may feel like one is simply seeking what is exciting, fascinating, has possibility of being a consuming meaning for oneself. But the body set and the mindset becomes too intense and taut. And it one becomes all expectation and demand upon reality if one isn't careful, so that something of nature is trampled. Something of nature is trampled. Remember, she's an earth nature goddess. And if I'm not relaxed enough, if I'm not into her affirmation of a present situation and present time, but I'm out seeking for the ultimate that's always beyond, it's so easy to lose Aphrodite. And I don't say any seeking, but there is a kind of seeking that you understand that's frenetic. Or when we get too quantitative in our seeking, going everywhere in all directions, kind of that type of seeking. But Aphrodite is quietly waiting. She can be felt sometimes in the margins of things, the margins of an undertaking, some leisure moments that mingle a little with longing and the empty mind. She is a goddess of enchanting byways and margins. It is said she has the sidelong glance. She was said to have the sidelong glance and the whispering voice. Those two descriptions of her, famous sidelong glance. So she sees not just the direct path. She sees almost, 180 degrees if she sees from side to side. And so this widens the horizon of what's possible and what has meaning, what has potentiality. Her look is less direct than one's usually goal-oriented way of looking. I once had a dream of working in an office, an actual night dream. I was working in an office, seeing people, consultations, and there was a little pause, 5 minutes, 10 minutes between hours, in which I went to an adjoining room and played an organ. And I had the most wonderful time in this dream, feeling a continuity of the margins. Everything, all the wonderful things were happening in the margins at the organ. The music seemed to enchant me and so forth. And I've later thought about that, at the time I didn't, but in connection with the Aphrodite, that she has a lot to do with margins that we just don't look at those margins of musing, of reflection, of where longing goes, where something goes unhoused in us, unhoused, unexpressed in us. And she may be waiting in those places. It is better to live farther in if one wants Aphrodite. Maybe this is my bias, but not aggressively seeking, not be withdrawn or passive, but allowing life to carry one and trusting its movement a little more. All right. There was a reference in the myth we read this morning, in the legend. Epiphyle said she had regularly gone on festive days, other days, making offerings to Aphrodite, and that she had garlanded her image with myrtle branches. Now, the myrtle tree was sacred to Aphrodite, and curiously, it was carried by the initiates in the procession of the greater mysteries of Eleusis. Myrtle branches were carried. And there's no reference that I've been able to find that associates that with Aphrodite in particular, in the mysteries. But it would be common knowledge that it had something to do with Aphrodite. Actually, it has to do with Aphrodite, I think, in her connection to Adonis. And so it is an underworld connection. Adonis was her beloved who died and whom she mourns. So it had, and Adonis lives again every year, comes alive again. It's both a Greek myth and Asia Minor myth. And so so it has an underworld connection. And a further connection it has, that maybe even Epiphyle would feel it, putting it on the cult image of Aphrodite, that the myrtle branch is connected to Dionysos in a particular myth. Do you remember you were making the statement yesterday, Celia? What were you quoting? Lightning married Semele.
My lightning
married mother, Dionysos speaking in Euripides' play.
Yeah.
I believe it. My lightning married mother, speaking of Semele, who was a mortal woman and struck by the thunderbolt of Zeus, not because he wanted to, but you know, and she was killed and went to the underworld. So Dionysos, in the course of his myths, goes to rescue his mother from the underworld. And when he goes, he carries the myrtle branch and offers it to Hades as a gift of this enduring green, which you don't have in the underworld. And in exchange for that, he asks for the release of his mother, and he carries her, he leads her away out of the underworld and up to Earth and then to Olympus. So the myrtle branch also has that sense, both with Adonis, who comes again from the dead, and with Dionysos, who brings Semele back from the dead, really has the rebirth, the return, the second time, the sense of second time. And I think we often overlook this with Aphrodite, that she, like Dionysos, is a god of the second time, too. That she also has an underworld process, that after a great deal of suffering and death, in the love sphere, wherever the love is in your life, that she has this power of coming again. And that's the meaning of the myrtle branch, is the god comes again, or the god penetrates the underworld and brings it up again. Actually, when Christ entered Greece, in the religion of Greece, the Adonia, the rituals of Adonis, which were celebrated in the springtime, the Adonia, were taken right into the Christian religion. And instead of Adonis lying in effigy and in death and borne through the streets, all garlanded with flowers, the image of Christ, the youthful, but he still carried that beautiful, beloved image for the women. And they mourned as they mourned for Adonis. They still do that to this day on Good Friday. And scatter the red anemone blossoms and trample them underfoot, and they are the blood of Adonis. They were anciently the blood of Adonis. Now they're the blood of Christ. And So the continuity is not just interesting, it's very archetypal. You can't hold the archetype down. No, you really can't. So anyway, I wanted to say those few things about the myrtle. Yes.
I'm hearing your description of the qualities of Aphrodite.
Yes.
I'm still turning with this morning's story. And
yes.
I have a sense also about her, almost a darker sense, that she rips you apart.
Mm-hmm.
That
she can.
This sense of her that she dangles the jewels, or she ultimately is responsible for Psyche's journey, that there's this sort of darker or ripping apart aspect to her, and ultimately it's an initiation that you come out, hopefully you come out the other side, but sometimes you don't. And the story this morning was a sometimes you don't.
Mm-hmm.
And my sense of her that she really teaches us about consequences.
Mm-hmm.
And I hear you begin to mention about the second chance in the underworld.
Mm-hmm.
And I would really like to hear more about that aspect of her.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yes. Yes, and I will speak more to that as the myths go on about that underworld and that return, that coming again of Aphrodite. You know, the gods for the Greeks were so, they weren't something apart from life. They were a certain deep lens right in existence. So they also represent how things are profoundly. Sitting there in the, as if they're up to their knees in the archetypal world, and so they did experience also a dark side to Aphrodite, but not dark in the sense of malicious. There's a real difference, or not evil. But just this is the way of things. This is how fate swings. Or much more the sense of a love fading, a love ending, say a love ends, as a, like the flower that fades. It had its season, and the flower faded. And so it behooves us to look and see if there's more to the process than the flower and the fragrance. And I really am believing more and more that Aphrodite has that capacity of being a deep goddess in the individuation process, where she does bring us to a fruit place. But anyway, more of that when we... Yes, I appreciate what you're saying about and the darkness of this morning's myth. Mm-hmm. There's a lot in Greek writing about, there's a lot in Greek writing about desire, about wanting something or getting a rich gift. Now here she's desiring the rich gift, isn't she? Epiphyle was desiring the rich gift. And I'm sorry, I can't remember the details of the story. Maybe somebody else remembers it. A story that Solon came upon, one of the seven great wise men and also one of the rulers of ancient Greece. I know he went to visit King Croesus, who was the richest man in the world. And Croesus showed him through. Plutarch describes this in his book. showed him through all of his rooms and his wealth, and Solon was a good guest, but he didn't, he hardly looked twice, he didn't ooh and ah, he said nothing about all this wealth. And finally Croesus said to him, "What? I can't believe it. I've shown you all my wealth. Have you anything in Greece that compares with this?" And Solon began to tell him about a man that worked. I don't remember whether he was a cobbler or what. He works all day, and he comes home to his wife and his children, and they lay out the bread and the olives and the wine and the cheese, and they eat, and they go to bed, and they get up. "Yes," he said, "I think I have found," Solon said, "the happiest man in the world." And I think Croesus' question was, "Have you seen any happier man in the world than I am, because I'm so rich?" And Solon put that to him, and he was just, he couldn't accept it, and he was just appalled that anybody described the simple form of life as the ultimate joyous one. Many years later, when he was going to his death.
And that is the end of the tape. Copyright C.G. Jung Society, Seattle, and the speaker. All rights reserved. No copying, please.